Looking at Matthew chapter 23, it's a chapter that I make reference to frequently for a number of reasons. I think there's just a tremendous number of issues addressed here that get to the heart of what the problem was with the nation of Israel as a whole, as represented by their leadership. Now, the ones who were not represented by this are represented throughout the gospel, and generally they are the ones who might be represented better as the blind man in John chapter 9. But by and large, the people who really identified with the Jewish nation are characterized in this way. I mentioned in the class that we recorded this weekend that it is pretty interesting to read commentators just kind of across the religious spectrum, how many people hate this chapter? And they hate it because they don't think it's appropriate for Jesus to be talking this way. This is not how Jesus talks. Well, I don't think they're entirely wrong. It's certainly not the way he makes a habit of talking, but that's all the more reason to pay attention. You know, I always paid particular attention to the coach that didn't yell on the one time that he did. The coaches that yelled all the time, you could kind of just tune it out. I mean, he's always screaming. But when Jesus becomes intense like this, oh, what's going on? What has happened? And so it really ought to grab our attention in that way. I think there are a lot of things in this chapter that are misunderstood. The Pharisees become sort of a catch-all phrase to describe anybody whose religion, a religious practice we don't like in some way. Oh, those people are Pharisees. And there's a lot of twisting that goes on, and we'll note some of that as we go along as to what is the issue and maybe also what isn't the issue, that Jesus is addressing in all of these rebukes. We started out in our class this weekend looking at the first phrase that Jesus uses here. He says the scribes and the Pharisees sit in the seat of Moses. In the New American Standard, it says they have seated themselves in the seat of Moses. And I think that maybe that's a dig at their usurping that authority. But one of the confusing elements may be there in verse 3 as we begin the chapter. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. If we go back through just the book of Matthew, we can already see, for instance, in Matthew chapter 12, where you have the disciples doing something that is different from what the Pharisees would tell them to do. And Jesus defends they're doing something different than the Pharisees would tell them to do. So we have to put some level of caveat on the do whatever the Pharisees tell you to do. I think there's a couple of caveats. First of all, I think it's that they sit in the seat of Moses. Don't throw Moses out because the Pharisees are hypocrites. What's a good lesson? Because what do people say about religion? I don't like religion because there's hypocrites. Don't throw God out. Don't go throwing his word out because the people who teach it or represent it in some way are bad representatives. So I think that's the first caveat. Follow what Moses says, and when they are saying what Moses says, you follow that. But then the other is do according to what they say, but not according to their works. And so that would pull away quite a bit of what they say, right? Their hypocrisy, don't follow after that part. So they say a lot of valid things. They do a lot of invalid things. And so there's certainly a great deal of measuring that has to be done in following that particular instruction. Overall, I don't think that he is exalting the Pharisees in this first statement, but rather making sure that they maintain their reverence for Moses, even as he is about to dress down the Pharisees throughout this text. Well, he says in verse 4, they bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. The idea is that for all this extra baggage that they add to the law, making it difficult for, I think common people especially, to follow the law. right? And so Matthew 12 is a good illustration of that. Here are people who are walking through the fields. They're not living the life of luxury that many Pharisees would live. And so they're walking through the field and they're plucking the heads of grain, a normal activity. And the Pharisees come and say, how dare you? Who do you think you are? Or they don't do the ceremonial hand washing, which is not necessarily something you could do all the time everywhere you are. But the Pharisees, you see, they've walled themselves in and made religion something that can only be practiced if you are of a certain maybe economic or political status. Outside of that, it's pretty much impossible. I think we still have to be careful about that today. If we think Christianity is a Western religion and maybe we go across the world somewhere and we want them to do it the way we do it, it gets real hard in a lot of places to do it the way we do it. Unless we're talking about the base elements of how we approach God to worship. I'm not talking about that. But there's a lot of elements that just are not necessary. They're helpful, but they're not necessary. And so we have to make sure that what we're, the burdens that we're bringing as we're teaching the gospel are what God brings to the table and not our traditions. So they put those burdens, and they're not helping anybody to meet those burdens. All they're doing is going around shaking their fingers and making sure that people are being persecuted for not carrying the burdens of the Pharisees. They themselves, however, verse 5, they do not work in order to please God. Rather, they have a very different motivation. Justin, what is the motivation that the Pharisees have as they do their works?
We often talk about the Pharisees in attributing them hypocrisy, which is accurate. But there's also several other things. I can think of three things in particular: greed, pride, selfishness. All these things drive them to do the things they do, say the things that they say. But what motivates that drive is to be seen by those out in public, those they come in contact with. It mentions in verse 5, they make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. You know, phylacteries is not a word we use. And so that, for my sake, I had to look it up, find out what it was. But it's a small leather box that would hold text. And so I could see them walking around and showing off the box that may be bigger than others. They broaden the border of their garments, which also did some research on, and they were particular about the tassels that hung from the garments that they wore. And they wanted folks to see those. And so the motivation behind all these things was they wanted to be seen, and that was it. They wanted to be called rabbi. They wanted to be called teacher. They wanted to be seen in public and greeted and have the best seats. And so all those things that I mentioned earlier, greed, selfishness, pride, hypocrisy, is the motivation or the drive behind what motivates them is their egos and what they want.
Yeah, and to illustrate that, you brought up phylacteries. Look back at Deuteronomy chapter 6. Just to illustrate the level of absurdity in what they are doing here. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, he says, beginning in verse 6, these words which I command you today, you shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. Verse 8, you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. All right. So when you look at a passage like that, the idea of having the law bound to you, to your hand, as a frontlet between your eye, on your doorpost, the idea is whatever you do, whatever you think, over your whole house, when you go out and come in, the law should govern everything about you. But here are people who said, you know, Let's remind ourselves of that. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, frankly. I was refinishing a door one time, and I found a little box nailed to the door. I'd never seen one of these, and I pried it off in order to refinish there. And there was a scroll inside, and I opened it up, and it was this portion of the law that was written in that little box. And the homeowner didn't know about it. And I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, put it back. I mean, don't throw it away. And I think there was a little bit of superstition there, but I don't mind. I mean, we put up scriptures in our home and that's all fine. What these people did, and you still see it today, they would wrap leather straps around their hand and actually run that up their arms and wear a box on their shoulder. And then they would strap a box on their forehead and wear it like a headband, right? Well, you might say, well, that's taken a little bit liberal or literal rather. You know, maybe it's a little bit like a WWJD bracelet or something, but okay, if it helps you, that's fine. They're not satisfied with that. They got to decorate them. And mine looks nicer than yours. And mine's a little bit bigger than yours. Must mean I love God more than you love God. And do you see how ridiculous that's getting? And they don't see it. Do you see how blind they are? That they don't see their the total missing of what God has instructed them concerning the law. They use the law in order to draw attention to themselves. And they have drawn the master's attention, but not in a good way. Well, it says, of course, and this has been illustrated already, they love the best places of the feasts. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces. They love to be called rabbi, to be called teacher, and etc. And then Jesus says, do not call anyone on earth your father. One is your father. Do not be called teachers. One is your teacher. And so forth. Lance, what is the problem with those titles? What's wrong with being called those things?
Well, the name rabbi, father, teacher, or master are all names that are given for God or Christ. And Jesus makes that clear when he says each one, because there's only one. And they're all for the spiritual leaders, which is God. Scribes and Pharisees loved having the spiritual special recognition, but only God deserves those names and the recognition that they represent. As Jesus has stated before, those that will be the greatest will be servants, and those that exalt themselves will be humbled, and those that humble themselves will be exalted. The scribes and the Pharisees, they both fall into the category of wanting the honor and not humbling themselves.
Yeah, and I think as we look through those, obviously, for your children to call you father is not an issue, right? That's not the issue. In fact, he would tell people, talk to people about honoring their fathers and mothers. Well, if you're not supposed to use that title, then that's really confusing instruction, right? So it's not that, but particularly as Lance said, these people want a particular honor that goes with those names. They want to be recognized as father in a way that's not appropriate. They want to be recognized as rabbi in a way. And I think particularly it's the demanding it on this side. You know, it's one thing for Paul to say that he thinks of Timothy as his son in the faith. And then for Timothy to think of Paul as his father in the faith. It's another thing to give him a particular, like a religious, an official title, father. Ooh, father of who? What are you talking about? Right? So I think to some degree it has to do with how much weight we're placing. I would describe it sort of like this, like we use the word elder. Well, any number of people might be called elder in the sense of what that describes. I'll let you decide who that is. But you might just say these are elderly people. But then the Bible sets aside that word in a way that is a title. Deacon, it certainly does this. Deacon just means servant. But then there's a role where God says this is a title. This is a specific role that you have. And in that way, I think father can be described, teacher can be described. All those things can be a description of the occupation that you have. But then there's a way that title is applied that Jesus says this is in that way you should. Maybe one more just to add in there that has some crossover. What about shepherd? There is the good shepherd. And that is not what our shepherds are. They don't have that role. But there's a sense in which they are shepherds but they're not the shepherd. And so there's got to be some distinction between those titles. So I think we need to sort of think through that as Jesus prescribes these titles not to be. Well, he goes on. He says, as Lance pointed out, that the greatest shall be a servant. It's the very opposite of wanting to be exalted. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted. So he goes then to the next one. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven. You shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. Chris, how do they go about, how could someone even shut up the kingdom of heaven? If you press the button on the bottom, there you go. It's
as we see here, he mentions shutting up the kingdom of heaven against men. And then in Luke 11:52, very similar, he says, woe to the two lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You do not enter in yourselves, and those who were entering in you hindered. And so in both cases, as we've already seen over several episodes, now over the last two or three chapters, Jesus has made it quite clear that they have no intent of listening to what he's saying. And therefore, they themselves have blocked the path, so to speak. And they are supposed to be the ones that have the knowledge and the ability to lead the people in the direction where they should be going, which is to be looking for the Messiah and to be welcoming the Messiah and see these signs for what they are. Instead, as it says here, they've taken away the key of knowledge. And so they've basically, in a sense, they've locked the door to the kingdom. And they're blocking it and doing anything possible to keep anyone else from going in because they themselves do not want to enter in. A lot of it has to do with the they want to keep their places and all. You mentioned John 9, the blind man. And that, in a lot of ways, is one of the things they would do. And it's just one example. Because he goes back and forth with him and says, when we went over there, it says, we know that God, why this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, yet he has opened my eyes. And by the end, they just say, you're born in your sins, get away from us, cast people out. And so typically, that's always what they do, and they'll continue to do that to the point where we've seen the triumphal entry, and by the end, they'll completely turn just about everyone else against the true Messiah. And so, unfortunately, that's what they've done.
Yeah, and just one more thing to add there to John 9 is the threat against the parents. We will kick you out. They just wielded so much power. But I think in terms of history, the links that various religiously powerful, well, religiously and politically powerful people have gone to, the links that they have gone to keep the ability for men to consider God's word on their own out of men's hands. It's incredible, the links that people will go to maintain that power that says, you come to us if you want to know about God. And they would kill, the blood that was spilled to keep people from being able to read their own Bibles is just phenomenal. And I think that those people certainly follow in the footsteps of the Pharisees, trying to shut up the kingdom of God. It's not just enough that they have made such a mess of it, but that they demand that other people follow their mess. And that is the pattern of the Pharisees. Well, he goes on. He says, along those lines, you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, verse 15, you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. And so, you know, when you win people to your way, you're taking them down, the wrong path. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. And so he introduces a number of ways that they go about making their oaths. And so what sorts of distinctions are they making here with these oaths? And I'll just extend that question till Sam gets a microphone back. Sam, what sorts of distinctions are they making about these oaths?
Well, it's typical Pharisees. They're trying to find a way to say something that sounds really important without it meaning any. And so they conjured up the idea that if we swear by the temple, you know, if we don't keep, we swear by the gold of the temple, then we're obligated transactions or whatever, I will. Or if they swore by the altar, necessarily obligated to keep the oath they had made. But if we go back to the Old Testament, you know, the Old Testament did swear falsely and live by it. Chapter 5, you know, he basically says, don't swear at all. He said, let your yes be yes and your no, no. In other words, if I tell Stephen, I'm gonna fix your car and it's gonna cost you $100, I need to stand by that. I don't have to swear by, but you know, whatever let my yes be yes. And those of us who are older remembers a time in this country that basically that principle was followed. You shook hands on a deal, whatever the deal was, I have to write it down on a piece. It was kept. And that's what Jesus
said. Yeah.
You don't need to be swearing by God or...
Yeah, and I think he uses some of the similar language here, or at least similar concept, to the, what he talks about in chapter 5. In chapter 5, the idea is don't swear by heaven, not by the earth, not by Jerusalem. And it gets down to not even the hair on your own head. And the thing that he does is says, essentially, he walks through each of those and says, they're all gods. All of those things are God's possessions. So they would say, in Matthew chapter 5, only keep your oaths to the Lord. It's all to the Lord. Right? It's all His. You can't get far enough away to where you think, you know, even your own hair, that's more God's hair than it is yours. He has more control over that than you do. And so I think similarly here, they're trying to make fine distinctions and say, here, this is more important. This is worthy, right? So this binds an oath, and then this is not worthy. And Jesus says, what are you talking about? What do you know about those very, it's all God's. And so whatever you're making your oath by, it is binding if you make the oath. But here are hypocrites who, like Sam said, they attach words so that people will think that they're earnest when they know that they are not earnest. I think about people who word things, maybe in a contract, maybe you word things in a way, you know they'll misunderstand this. I think contracts are written that way sometimes. In fact, there's lawsuits sometimes about that you knew that the customer would misunderstand this. But they write it in such a way that they can say, well, actually what we meant was this. And if you look right here at this language, and that's very similar, I think, to this, is intentionally misleading someone about what you mean. And of course, we could take it all the way down to, again, looking at the ridiculousness of this. This is about like a child who says, I had my fingers crossed. What does it even mean? You know, that's nothing. And that's essentially what he's saying to them here. What distinction? You had your fingers crossed? What are you, children? But they are. They're very much like children. All right, verse 23. So he says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy. Dean, what is wrong with the tithing that the Pharisees are doing?
Well, again, kind of like what Justin was talking about, they're doing these types of work to be seen. They're publicly coming out with these tithes of the herbs and the seeds, similar to what was shown in Leviticus 27. Where there was tithing of the seeds of the land and the fruits of the tree, but they were doing it in such detail and weighing out these items so precisely and making sure they didn't give any more than they had to. And again, just all to show the people that were watching how godly they were and strict in their tithing. And they were very strict and precise in these small matters of the law and all these performances of all the rites and ceremonies of religion and even the tradition of their fathers and the elders. But Jesus pointed out that they were ignoring those weightier matters of the law of judgment, of mercy, and faith. And even Luke's account, you know, says they were neglecting justice and the love of God. So Something else I found interesting in that was that how God pleaded with Israel back in Micah 6 about what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. And we see that Jesus reminds them that they're neglecting the weightier matters. They have ought to have done those, but without leaving the others undone, showing that all matters of the law must be kept. And their attention to even the smallest points of the law as God is proper, but it shouldn't interfere with the higher and more important parts of the law. And something else I found, too, was over in Isaiah's prophecy, where they Jesus uses that prophecy back in chapter 15 in Matthew, that they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men, but calling them blind leaders.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the issue is they started on the wrong end. And I particularly like what you brought out about the motivation connecting that with what Justin said, that they're, even the thing that they're doing correctly, they have bad motives, and so even that is not done correctly. It's not done right. But the problem is not that they are doing this thing. And I remember I was preaching a lesson on this particular passage somewhere, and I said, Jesus is not, he is fundamentally not saying you Pharisees are wrong because you tithe. And there was a woman who said, well, I thought that's exactly what the problem was, is that they thought that that was important. And I said, the law says it is important. And she missed that part where these you ought not to have left undone. But the idea that if you start with the weightier matters and the idea of justice and mercy and faith, why then tithing would be a part of that. You see that? You couldn't focus on those and then disregard tithing. But the other way is not true. You could focus on tithing, and if you maintain these elements and you keep this kind of relationship, then you want to hear. I do think this, that there is an element where the seeds, the tithing is just a matter of math, right? It's just counting. And if you can count to 10, then you can tithe. But there's no math really for justice, mercy, and faith, is there? You can't just calculate that. There's no equation to arrive at there. That takes a more difficult path and sort of wrestling with concepts and wrestling with ourselves very often to arrive at those kinds of matters. But you can completely detach your heart and count to 10. Ask an accountant. You know, you don't have to be passionate. You just count. But here there's a great deal more that's being required of them. The other element that just to add there is just the total imbalance and just not understanding, not understanding the ridiculousness. Again, ridiculous is a word I think of throughout this chapter, of going over here and saying, hey, there's something right here. I think there's something right here in my soup. Meanwhile, the soup is rotten. It has been noted that both the gnat and the camel would be unclean meat. And so they've got a camel that they're willing to eat, to swallow. But wait a minute, I think I see something right here. It's just a ridiculous picture. It's like the beam and the moat. And so I think that's part of the issue. It's not that we want gnats in our food. You know, we're not looking to have gnats in our food. But let's start with the camel. Then we can see better maybe to get the gnats. Maybe it's the camel there that's attracting the gnats. You know, think about that. Well, he goes on and he says, you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of extortion. They're full of extortion and self-indulgence. Jeff, what's wrong with cleaning the outside of a dish? Do you clean the outside of your dishes?
Yes, I do, but I clean the inside more importantly.
Yeah.
The part that my food and my body is going to come in contact with either. This is an interesting one because some people bounce back to Mark chapter 7, an incident where Jesus and the scribes and Pharisees tangled over Jesus' disciples not observing some of the food rituals you were referring to and not cleansing, cleaning themselves before eating bread. and specifically not dealing with the cleaning of the cups, pitchers, and pots. So this would be something very meaningful and understood by the Pharisees and the scribes. But also, everyone knows what a vessel is and what it's for. Everybody knows what a glass is for. And these are vessels to, and for someone to say, you're like a dish, I'm only cleaning the outside, but the inside is filthy. But Jesus doesn't even make it that vague. He makes it even more pointed in that he says, and on the inside, he doesn't say on the inside the dish is dirty. He describes the inside of the Pharisee. Yeah. So there is no opportunity for this one to be missed. He says, you scribes, you Pharisees, you're hypocrites, because you're like a vessel that you polish on the outside for people, but on the inside, it's filled with your corruption. He describes it as full of robbery and full of self-indulgence. Well, we've already addressed both of those. Robbery being the devouring of widows' houses and not showing mercy. The self-indulgence we've described this evening, seeking the best places and saying long public prayers and seeking to be seen and heard of men, seeking the places of authority both in social and in religious events, demanding others to obey all the law and all the additional traditions that they put in place, but yet they wouldn't to observe them themselves. So you see their hypocrisy, you see their uncleanliness on the inside, but they're trying to polish the outside.
Yeah. And again, cleaning the outside's not the problem. It's leaving the inside. If you go to a restaurant and you order a glass of water and there's a stain on it, your first question is probably going to be, especially if you've already taken a drink, is that on the outside or the inside? Now, if it's on the outside, you're not going to be like, oh, I don't mind having a dirty glass. No, you still want a clean glass, but you'll be relieved because it's not on the inside. And so it's again, a matter of importance. Where do you start? And you can survive, with unclean on the outside. Some people would take this and say, you see, it only matters what's in my heart. Well, there's a sense in which that is true to a degree. But a lot of times what they mean is no matter what I'm doing out here in the world, as long as I've got a pure heart, that's sort of Gnosticism. That would mean the inside's not clean, right? If the outside is unclean in terms of righteousness, then the inside's unclean. But here what you have is people hiding their wickedness with that whitewashing of the tomb. And inwardly, as Jeff has described here, is the condition that Jesus lays out, their hypocrisy and lawlessness. Well, Jesus goes on, speaking of tombs, he brings up the tombs of the prophets. And Larry, how would the Pharisees, how would they suppose they would have treated the prophets of old? It should be on.
Okay, this seems to be just kind of, I guess, deja vu with the scribes and Pharisees in their attitude. They, in condemning their forefathers, they condemned themselves. And it seems like the Jews took great measures in commemorating lives of the deceased kings and prophets to the extent of their tombs were often filled with treasures and tribute. But according to one, Josephus talks about one Hyrcanus, which plundered 3,000 talents of silver from David's tomb, and that Herod the Great entered it himself. And then he goes further to say that there were impressive marble monuments set up for some of the forefathers, and mentioned was Abraham and probably many others. But the scribes and Pharisees seem to pride themselves in the outward appearance rather than inward things. And it seemed here that they have imagined that constructing impressive monuments to the prophets and the righteous identified them with these departed servants of God. And Jesus just lets them know that this is just not the case. And Jesus points out that acknowledging these persecuted fathers identified them who killed the prophets. In other words, they were children of their fathers when they followed the sinful mindset of the ancestors that prosecuted the prophets or the. And so this is, I guess, as we would say, they kind of But one thing we, I guess, need to think about is that when men are intent on doing wrong, God does not stand in their way, but gives them over. And so it seems like the scribes and Pharisees boasting or promoting themselves to be superior. And yet at this very time, they were seeking and plotting to kill the greatest. And so since they were unwilling to change their lives in any way, I guess it's no wonder that their hatred grew for the one who was able to see. So he says, Jesus tells them just to, you know, go ahead and finish. And so I think it seems that the maybe the crowning sin of the father's guilt would be the killing of God.
Yes. And so as they look back, they think themselves the inheritance of the good guys, being on the side of the good guys. And we would never have been like those people over there. Everybody does that, right? Everybody looks back at history and they think we would have been on the quote right side of history. We would have stood up on this side. Look, if you go along with whatever, cultural parade with whatever, the path of least resistance is now, you probably would have done it then too. The difference is for these people, they're going to get to prove it. Because as you pointed out, they're going to go kill the prophet of prophets, the king. Andrew, in bringing that up, why does Jesus use Abel and Zechariah?
I could think of probably two reasons, I guess. The first one, and maybe the primary reason, is Abel being the son of Adam is like the very first unrighteous death that there ever was. And then Zechariah would have been much more recent. So it's just like Abel, Zechariah, and everybody in between. Just all the unrighteous blood that has been shed. But also, I thought maybe it might have to do with just the severity of the unrighteousness associated with their deaths as well. Because we don't know a whole lot about Abel, but we know he was righteous. So we know he made a sacrifice that was pleasing to God, and he died because of that. And just the senselessness, the unrighteousness of that is very striking. And then Zechariah, I assume this is the prophet who wrote the book of Zechariah, son of Berechiah. And so much of his message was about building the temple. It was about restoring worship to God, and yet that's where they murdered him.
Yeah.
It's very, very striking.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit difficult to figure out who Zechariah is here. He is called the son of Berechiah, but we have no notion of his death. If he was murdered, it's not recorded for us. There's another Zechariah that was murdered, but he's the son of not Berechiah, and so it doesn't seem like it could be him. There is a Zechariah, son of Berechiah, who was killed in the temple during the life of Christ. And so that is a potential there. So I don't know who it is, but I think that you're right in probably in some way he's bookending all the murders. And he's starting here with Abel and whatever Zechariah he's talking about on this other end. And some speculate it may be that Zechariah in the story of Joash. He is the one. And that would be the last murder of a prophet recorded in the historical books as they're laid out in the Jewish Old Testament. So maybe that's what it is. But in some way he's saying from the very first time this happened to either textually or chronologically, the last time it happened and everybody in between. And I think that would be the reason he would pick those out. Well, we have a couple more questions, but our time is run short. And so if you were slated to answer a question tonight, be looking out for an email or a text for next week, and I'll have you on the list for then. Appreciate everybody's good attention. Appreciate all the participation of the men who agreed to answer the questions. This is so much.